Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource supported by our listeners. To find out how and learn more about the program, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We also thank the Management Learning Journal and the European Group for Organizational Studies for their wonderful support. Now on with the show.
Welcome to episode 94, where we discuss a contemporary classic, Situated Learning, Legitimate Peripheral Participation, by Jean Lave and Etienne Wenger, published in 1991 by Cambridge University Press. This is part one of the episode where we will examine what Lave and Wenger describe as situated learning and legitimate peripheral participation, and how they derived these ideas from five diverse case studies. To learn more about the text, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Hi, this is Tom, calling from Carlisle, Pennsylvania in the United States.
And this is Pedro coming to you from Copenhagen. Today we are delighted to have with us Davide Nicolini as a guest. Davide is professor of organizational studies at Warwick Business School. His research focuses on the development of practice-based approaches and the study of organized work and organizational phenomena. He has examined, in particular, topics related to knowledge or knowing, learning, change, and innovation. He has conducted in-depth qualitative studies in a variety of industries, ranging from healthcare to factories to engineering firms and even building sites. Davide has also been a guest in a previous episode related to the PDW Classics of Organizational Theory, which took place in the Academy of Management annual meeting in 2022. This event focused on approaches to the study of work, and Davide talked about in that occasion about the tradition related to the Tavistock Institute of Human Relations, where he has worked in the past. Thank you, Davide, for being with us.
You're very welcome. It was long overdue, as I've seen these things grown since day one.
Indeed.
And congratulations again for keeping these things going. It's a great pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you. So indeed, I forgot to say that Davide has been a listener and a supporter since the origins of the podcast. So in a way, it's great to have him here after all this time as a listener in his new role as, you know, a guest.
Yeah, why don't you go ahead and tell us a little bit more about yourself, and then we'll get right into the text.
Yeah, so you never ask academics to tell things about themselves, otherwise the time flies really quickly. I will tell you why I was very happy to actually talk about this text. In many ways, this text for me was transformational of my intellectual journey. So just for information, I trained first as an educational psychologist, and then I retrained as a philosopher of science. And then because I have a little bit of hyperactive deficit disorder, I actually branched out in organizational theory, which actually is the place where all these things come together. And because of my background, of course, I gravitate around issues of organizational knowledge, decision-making, but what do you consider sort of like mental or cognitive aspects? And we're talking about many, many years ago. And serendipitously, really, once I went to a conference where they were talking about cognitions in organizations. And then I heard a presentation from from the director of the center where Lave and Wenger were actually working, of which we can say something more later. And I was just struck. I just had one of those epiphanies that the things they were saying were so interesting, so logical. And having been just reconverted myself into an empirical scholar, they were saying things that make a lot of sense. And so reading the book and speaking with Etienne Wenger first, I met Jean Lave only a couple of times and much later. It was really a way to just redesign my area of interest. So on the back of the book that we're going to discuss, I started my first ethnography of how people learn to become constructions managers. And then the rest is history, meaning that I kept continuing to use both ethnography to study how people work and learn, and then to deal with issues to do with increasingly connected issues of learning, knowledge transfer, or knowledge sharing, knowledge translations, how knowledge goes. And more recently, I branched that into attention. That seems a big jump, but actually it's very similar. which is issue how organizations do attentions. So I'm very happy to go back to this book, which actually I had the chance to revisit recently because in occasions of the 30th year of publications of the book, we decided to just take stock of one of the lines of work that stems from this work, which is the cottage industry of communities of practice, of which we can talk maybe later. And we just published, together with our three colleagues, a broad review of the work done on community of practice. Actually, this article had a history of the link between community practice and legitimate prefab participations, but that was the part that our reviewers liked less. So that's the one that has been cut as it happens.
So one interesting feature of this book, and David was already hinting at that, is that it has started and has revolutionized the way we think about learning and knowledge in a variety of fields, right? But I think one thing that we get from reading the book and the very fact that it was part of a series, right, that had many important other authors and works related to that, like the work of Lucy Stutchman that we covered on episode 22, is that it is clearly part of a conversation that seems to be happening at a particular place in time, right? The way the different references and cases, you know, it's very clear that it's a collective effort to rethink the way we think about learning, right? And I think that maybe we could start, as you suggested, by trying to think about where are these ideas coming from, right? What is exactly the milieu in which such book, you know, came to be?
Yeah, thank you. I actually, if any of the listener have the chance to get a hold of a copy, I suggest that they don't skip the list of the other books in this series, as you said, which is actually a descriptions of a very tight-knitted, what do you call it, epistemic community, or sort of like-minded scholars, located in a very specific place and time. They were all on the West Coast of the United States, all toward the 1980s, and they all gravitated around the new philosophy of mind and the intersection between the study of artificial mind in different ways. So okay, we're talking about the year in which people started to think about computer, new way of doing computers. So this is okay, so the place where the idea of computing as something that without typing things on the computer happens. So the same place where the community practice was invented, the legitimate is the same building where the mouse was invented, and more or less in the same, a few years after, so to speak. So this the environment was the attempt to develop some of the alternative ways of thinking of cognitions in general. Okay, the alternative, the sort of like the California sort of alternative people that were working on the side of those who were actually the serious people in suit and tie, were developing the expert systems of the first generations of artificial intelligence, which actually, as we all know, then proceeded to die in the famous AI winter. So these are all people who coming from a variety of backgrounds, mostly were anthropologists, educationalists, and technologists, started to think there was a different way of thinking cognition stuff in order to inform then the understanding of the interaction between computers and people, but also how to design computers. Broadly speaking, this is the same part of the world where Gregory Bateson was doing things, where cybernetics was all the rage. And I know some of the people personally, and there was a lot of back and forth. Jodo Engström, which is named several times in the books that we'll see maybe later on, also was in San Diego doing a 6 months, he was spending half a time. So these people were in touch. And as I said, they're all involved on the boundary between the science of cognitions, cognitive science and social sciences, okay? So Jean Lavie was an anthropologist, but Etienne Wenger is an engineer. He's a Swiss engineer who went to work with Xerox. So I was actually working before writing the book, working in a part of Xerox, which sort of like the famous Xerox Park, directed by John Seely Brown, in which among other things they were discussing, they were studying the concept of cognitive apprenticeship, which was one of the way to, again, to try to understand how people acquire knowledge in ways which are different from the traditional instructions. Yeah.
Yeah, and I like the fact that the word apprenticeship was brought into it because it sort of paints a picture of a type of learning or a type of teaching, a type of coaching, mentoring. And what I think is kind of different is that the traditional mental image that we get with apprenticeship is sort of like there's a beginning and an end. There's the master who takes on an apprentice, trains the apprentice, educates the apprentice, basically, and it's all, you know, and we'll get into what situated learning means momentarily, I'm sure. But basically at the end, once the apprentice is able to go off, you have a new somebody who is able to go on with the master. By adding cognitive to it, it sort of brings us a much richer range of situations in which you have a master or someone in a position of mastery looking at the apprentices coming in with the express purpose of trying to perpetuate the field. And that was the big part in when we look at the book, of which is dominated by case studies. That was one of the resonant themes that I took away, was how it's not just a matter of there being masters and apprentices, but the master-apprentice relationships exist for a reason, to perpetuate a particular, whether it's a specific field or a specific profession, or in a really interesting case, the Alcoholics Anonymous participants, how they perpetuate, I guess the best way to describe it is the using stories to correct past behaviors and be able to perpetuate that as both method and effect.
So maybe you can rewind just a little bit and give a quick overview of this which is actually a very short book, right? But very dense. And in my reading, what seems to be happening is that the book starts with kind of an overview and taking stock where the conversation was, which was exactly at the model of apprenticeship, right? And from that, they push further the conversation by introducing exactly the idea of legitimate peripheral participation, right, in situated learning. And from that, we get the cases that Tom was referencing, right? These ideas were built on the back of a lot of empirical research. And that's what I was saying before, that is clearly a conversation that is taking place, right? Because you can really see that they're drawing from their own previous research, but research from people that they were clearly in contact with. And then towards the end, they try to draw out the implications from a new way of thinking about, you know, curriculum, education, and of course, the idea of communities of practice. So to rewind to the idea of the apprenticeship, I think what is interesting here is that I saw it a little bit different, Tom. That is, it's almost like a decentering of this dual relationship between, you know, master and novice, and trying to look at a relational, social way in which people are participant in a community, and looking exactly of how the participation matters and the way in which the participation happens as the locus of the learning, right? And at the same time, the locus and the mechanism for it.
Yeah, you said it better than I did.
So yeah, there is a traditional way of simplifying the concept of legitimate peripheral participations, trying to say it's a form of cognitive apprenticeship, okay, which I said was in the back of their mind. Actually, Levi Wenger especially Jean Lave, goes to quite a length to try to dispel this idea. Okay, so the idea of the book is that apprenticeship in its historical forms, so there is no one apprenticeship, there are many forms of apprenticeship, is one of the manifestations of a more, deeper or more profound, but it's just more basic mode of learning. So legitimate peripheral participations is derived inductively from a number of studies. So this is an inductive book, right? It's really, so again, this is the same milieu that we described before, and there's one element that we'll add later on, but it's the same place where grounded theory was born, by the way, and in the same period, right? So the idea here is that we have a multi-case studies and want to distill what is the mechanism that underpinning all this. For brevity's sake, we can say that legitimate participation is actual apprenticeship. It's actually not, because apprenticeship is one of the historical forms in which LPP manifests itself. And remember, Jean Lave is anthropology. She had read Thompson's Making of the English Working Class. And she knows very well, and I think she mentions in the book or in this or another book, that actually apprenticeships in its some of historical forms can be highly dysfunctional and terrible for people. It's exploitative. People can treat badly. There's a lot of violence involved. Apprenticeship can be used to keep people in their place. Jean Leib has read extensively and quotes extensively Bourdieu, so she knows all these things. So she's very careful to say that, you know, she's not celebrating a romantic view of apprenticeship. She repeated this over and over. She's interested to develop an analytical tool for understanding how apprenticeship works so that it can apply to other places. So that's why the concept went so far out in the world, including going back into schools, because it describes learning not only in traditional apprenticeship relationships, but also in other places.
Right. And indeed, one of the so there's five case studies that they brought in this book, one of them being the apprenticeship of meat cutters, which was clearly a bad news story. This is one case that she introduces that shows the apprenticeship process is not only used to control apprentices, but it even prevents them from learning. I mean, it's almost built to try to keep them at bay and not allow them to learn the ropes of the job. So there's an example, you know, the example straight from the book of where that's the case. It's exploitative or whatever.
Again, for our reader, this is a very interesting news of a dissonant case, right? She has five cases, which, by the way, is not of her making. So she has developed most of her ideas in a study of the Vaiangola tailors in Liberia. So in 1988 and 89, Leib went to Africa and spent there about 2 years in different times. But then when she comes back, she taps into the study of the IRL. So these other studies were made by other people within the same milieu. So Hutchkins, who is the sort of the father of distributed cognition, Gitti Jordan, who was an employee from Xerox, who was an anthropologist who went to study the Yucatan midwives. Unfortunately, she passed away a few years ago. And then, of course, there's Becker's ethnography of the apprenticeship of the butchers. But she only did one of the case studies. So what she did, she picked up the case study. She tried to use it to find out what are the critical elements of this process, of this mechanism that they're trying to identify. And then they use the butchers to show how it doesn't work. So as a contrast one, very good presentation strategy, which I strongly recommend to other people who do the same.
One quick note then when we were saying, you know, the examples and situations in which we may see this juncture of misalignment between the learning, right, and the work or the any kind of other concerns that exist in communities of practice. We also had the case of Isabel Mendes' leave study of the nursing hospital, episode 88, right, which is an interesting case as well, which shows exactly that. We discussed that in a few episodes back in the podcast. So for the listeners, just a hint. So why don't we try to make sense of the very concept, right? What is about the legitimacy, the peripherality, and the participation in such concepts that the book tries to put forward?
I'll certainly take a stab at it. And since this is, you know, I'm kind of reading this book for the first time myself, I'll start with peripheral, because this is perhaps from the field in which I work, peripheral usually sounds rather distant and detached, but it's definitely not the case in this way. This is where it sounds to me like we're talking about the position of the learner in relation to the both the master and the task or the knowledge that's being gained. You're sort of starting from an outside posture, observing, watching, trying to gather in what is the nature and character of the task, and then slowly being drawn closer in as the apprentice is given more responsibility or more trust, more whatever, to go in and do more until such time that they've achieved mastery, and then they're no longer peripheral. They're essentially, they've made that transition to the core. But the notion of peripheral struck me as very important, because it's a different use of peripheral than I'm accustomed to. It's not detached, but it is of a measured distance or purposeful distance to the task.
Right. So I want to push back a little bit from Pedro. So the title of the book is Situated Learning and Legitimate Peripheral Participation. So we should only start with the first one. Okay. And also the first part of the book actually is a journey, right? again, let me go back to the history of the book and the milieu. So behind this book, there's another very strong influence, which is the influence of the Vygotsky psychology, okay, which is cited, but as again, if you look at the list of the other books in this series. So within this particular community of people that generated this idea, there was a strong influence of the work of Vygotsky, which was rediscovered in California about the time. So to make long story short, Vygotsky had an idea of learning as something that people do actively, okay, it's a form of personal transformation, acting in the world by interiorizing suggestions or tools that they pick up inside to move to basically close a gap of what he calls the zone of proximal development, as individual process whereby there's few things where I am, where I want to go, what we call a gap nowadays, right? And learner faced with a gap, grab all the resources they can, they put them together in order to gap these things. And when they interiorize this, they have learned how to go on, how to do things, right? So if I have to divide some cakes to some people, I don't know how to do it. I go to the internet, I learn how to do divisions, or the teacher tells me how to do the divisions, I read it. I learn how to do the things, and then I can use it next time in order to be sure that all the children get the same amount of cake and don't hit each other, right? And you can see that this is an idea of learning as something that people do using tools, interiorizing, okay, building on resources that are historical, come somewhere else. That was quite radical in terms of pedagogical intervention, right? Because in the school, in this case, instead of teaching people the rote of how to do divisions, you give them a problem, you give them sources, they get on with yourself. This is active teaching, right? So this is the 1960s and 70s in America and California. Okay, so people wanted to do schooling in a more democratic way. And this is what is behind this, okay? Jean Leven-Wanger said that this is behind the interest for situated learning. The learning is situated in this practice. So the learning is something that the students, the pupils do. In America, this sensitivity comes also from the pragmatist traditions where learning is seen as an inquiry. You have a problem, you have to learn by sort of like a searching solution. So the two streams are conjoined. What Leven-Wanger say in the book is that this particular interest, which is, as I said, was prevailing in this group of people of which they were belonging, is very much focused on the transitions, on the personal transformations, why the social aspect, the social relationships between people, between people and the bigger world, so to speak, is a little bit disappeared. Still, Vygotsky was right in the beginning of the century, it was still a little bit of a center on the individual, so to speak, okay? So this legitimate participation is a way, okay, of putting the social into situated learning. So it reconfirms the idea that learning is something that we do by learning how to go on in a real activity in the real world. That's the situated bit, okay? It develops this idea that I said partly came from the Vygotsky traditions, that to learn, you have to do something. You just, okay, it's not absorbing something. It's not just like listening. You really have to be active and combine these resources in such a way that then become yours. So internalizations is really sort of like, so this is only part of the story, is that situated learning then has, in the real world, also has a social dimensions. And the social dimension manifests itself as this trajectory in this social process that need to be legitimate, peripheral, and that has to include participations. So the two things we have to keep together, if that makes sense.
It does, of course. And when I read the book, right, and thinking exactly of this analytical movement that Leven-Wanger tried to do, going back to something that Tom said before, you know, I think what is interesting is that you can see that the learning is happening for something, right? This pragmatical thing that you're talking about, right? There is an effort by bringing the debate about the community where the learning is happening to show that A, it's part of the way through which the community is reproducing itself, right? So the learning is attached to a broader, I don't want to say purpose, right? But there is this link in which as the learning is happening, the community is reproducing itself, but of course changing in the process, because what the learners bring And in the process of learning, right, in participating, there are different ideas, there is reproduction, but there is also no potential conflicts and all sorts of changes that can happen from that, right? Because since it's something that is social and alive, it's there is, you know, of course, always changing. And the other thing is also how, and I think that's what you were saying, right, is that the person itself is changing in the process, right? So I think that what making this move and putting situated learning and the idea of legitimate peripheral participation together, it shows that it's part of a community in which the learning is happening that is trying to, you know, continue and in the process of always changing. But also the person that is participating is changing because it's becoming part of something, right? So it is more than just observing. And I think that's very compelling, the analysis that they make, to show that it's not just about seeing someone doing something, you know, it's peripheral because you're just observing, but that you are doing it and what you're doing, how engaged with it, and how you see the people have their own ideas and how they relate to that, what is accepted in that particular space, right? And how you try to do that and increasingly progressing to a mastery of what are the core tasks of the community, right? In the process, you're also becoming something and, you know, being part of the social relations that exist.
One way of making sense of this, so first of all, Lev and Wenger are clear that the three aspects have to be taken together. They cannot be so, okay, and there is no opposite. There is no illegitimate central non-participation learning, okay? So one way of thinking of the relationship between legitimate peripheral participations and community practice, I think, is to start with the practice, okay? And I'm saying somewhere else. So the idea is this. Jean Slave idea is that every practice produces and depends on a number of relations between people. People doing things, talking with each other, using certain tools in a certain way is how a practice reproduces itself. This is Bourdieu in actions, and this is the idea of practice that is behind the book. So the question is, how do we call analytically this connection between people and things that rotates around the practice? And they call it a community, okay? The idea of legitimate participation is you don't learn, you become a member of this social gathering, if you want to call it, of this sort of like social network of relationship, which is not a community because it's not flat, it's not everybody loves each other. In fact, power and inequalities are built into the community practice and the process of legitimate participation because, of course, the very idea that there is a master and a person that has to learn creates already the hierarchical differentials. Okay, so a person becomes a member, and this goes, as you said, learning to do something well. Okay, is acquiring your identity. You not only are hired into university, you become a university professor, you become a scholar. Tom, I don't know what type of research you do, but I know well what Pedro does. Pedro, when he learned, he didn't just learn how to do ethnography, he became an ethnographer, okay? He started to dress like an ethnographer, he started to talk like an ethnographer. I'm joking, okay? But we were joking with Pedro that one of the first things that people who want to become an ethnographer or at least an anthropologist, they go to the first shop and they buy themselves a moleskin little booklet, those notebooks with the skin on the outside, so which in the old time were sort of devised so that when it rains in the forest where you're taking notes about the tribe, the water doesn't ruin your precious notes, okay? So this is what we're talking about, okay? Participations as a way of becoming rather just. Remember, the opposite is the idea. That's what I said. Okay. The idea that learning is just having something imprint in your mind or having acquiring concept, right? So this is the things for which we get away. Okay. So we had already gone away with the Vygotskian traditions, or if you want, with more active learning from the pragmatist traditions. Here we inject a strong form of relations with other, of social aspects, so to speak. So I become among other and through others in relation with others. And that, so one of the confusions of the book is that people ignore completely two things that the author says in the book. First, that community practice should not be reified, and that's, we put that on Etienne Wenger. And the second thing is that there's no such a thing as a center or periphery of a community. For years, people were saying, you know, what's sort of like, where is the periphery of community? I've seen people drawing circle center. I said, Where in the book they said, no, we're talking about full immersion, okay, or not full immersion, on the assumption that if you're not allowed to participate in full, which means not only do the things, but also being subject to these implications of mistakes, you don't learn, because learning, becoming, okay, includes also taking the risk and suffering from the consequences. So if you are a Viangola tailor, okay, if you make a mistake, you may be punished even physically from your masters, okay? So this is what we're talking about, participation. But if you don't do that, you will never become. You learn how to do the motion, so to speak, but you never become. That's the idea of full participation.
So at some point in my notes, when on the side of the books, I wrote two things I think that relates to that. One is that the picture I got from all the cases and the theorizing was very much that they're trying to say that people need to have skin in the game to learn, right? So learn is not just happening because it's not something that just happened in your head. You're participating, you are doing the tasks, you're trying to understand what people are, how they're doing things, and you slowly progress to doing more things, different things, right? There's something about, and it's a process of becoming, is because you are entwined to what is happening. You're doing actions, and actions can have consequences. So it's exactly that, which comes very strongly across, right? And the other one, and I was trying to say, but it was not clear, is that you can see there is something at stake for the communities, because I think at some point in the foreword, which is actually very helpful in setting up the whole book and, you know, its key ideas, is that learning here starts to be not just a practice, a thing, but a dimension in a way that is part of social life, which is exactly that. That is the shift in understanding that learning is something that we are continuously doing, right? It's not just something that's happening in the school. So this shift from only the abstract cognitive allows us to see the risks and involvement people have, but also how it is part of a number of social processes, right? Beyond just formal education and so on.
And the foreword is interesting because that's the first person who, we assume this first person who read the book, who went, wow, these things happen everywhere, not only in school, not only in the places where they're, but anytime you learn, you know, to become expert in any hobby or, you know, even sports, etc., if you scratch the surface, you will find some elements, most of the elements of the legitimate peripheral participations. And then as long, if you want to call not your club, but your sport, you know, you learn how to do tennis, okay? So you become a tennis player. So if you want to call that a community practice, you know, you have the full package. Yeah, I wanted to say that one of the implications of the idea of full participation is that the issue of access, which is discussed in the back of the book, becomes critical. And this is extremely timely. And I know because writing 30 years later, a review of the community of practice, we realize that the problem is absolutely still present. So the idea of access is that if you don't have access to the practice, if you're not allowed because you are either not legitimized or you are not allowed to participate in practice, or you're prevented to participate in practice because the practice is non-transparent, is black box somewhere, okay? So if you're not allowed to put sort of to do the things, to participate, you will not learn. So your learning will have some gaps and to some extent, you will not become a good practitioner. So the case is exemplified, as Tom was saying, by the case study of the butchers, in which the organizational structure prevents both the social relation, but also prevents people to do the things they need to do in order to learn. And okay, so what's called the learning curriculum. So learning curriculum is the opportunity I need to learn to become a good practitioner seen from the practitioner themselves, rather than from the teacher. But there is also the issue that some technology may prevent this, okay? So 30 years later, we have the case of what we call sort of black box technologies. So one of the problems we have that is that a lot of the things that we happen to work are either prepackaged in apps or happens inside computers. And so this prevents or creates new challenges for people who have to learn. And there's been some recent ethnographies of learning, like the one from Beanie on how to become a surgeon using robots, that shows the issue of access and the transparency and accessibility of the practice as a way for making the legitimate participations working in full potentials. is very much present. And the so-called sort of, you know, machine learning and all the AI is going to make things even more complicated. If your pessimistic person says that this is going to make mean that people will not learn, the reality is that people always find work around and invent ways around these things because the world has to go on. But the issue is exactly as they framed it in 1991.
I think we can pin a little bit this because I think it would be interesting to talk about that relation to technology, but also whether this is a new form of de-skilling, right? Which I think that's what you're hinting at. But what, to going back to something that Tom was saying, right? On the master and novice and all of that, I think the fact that the involvement is so important, the participation is so important, also shifts the conversation. And, you know, the book's very clear about that. From the skill and competence of the masters, so to speak, right, to the conditions in which the learning happens, right, which I think it's quite revolutionary. And I think there's something at some point that in the foreword that they say that it's the challenge of learning is less about the representation that the master may be able to transfer and more about the opportunities and resources that you're saying right now, right, that exists for the person to learn. And that is connected to the artifacts of the community, the extent in which the person can handle that and understand its transparency and the way in which the participation is structured, right? So there is interesting discussion about the progression of tasks in which the novice goes through, in which in some cases it's designed in a way that you may start by, because of course you are doing things and there are consequences, by more less risky work to the ones that, you know, you are asked to, you know, take a more central and more complex set of activities, right? It's really a rethink in how we still today instinctively think about educational learning, right? Because it's trying to decenter the idea between these two, this communication, this assumed communication, in trying to put that the quality, the possibilities, the opportunities are actually the ones that exist in the conditions that exist in the community.
I absolutely agree. And that is one, remember, a little bit early on, I was pushed back by the idea of reducing the process to apprenticeship. I said apprenticeship is sort of like one of the versions. And this is for two reasons. First of all, because the legitimate participation, the daily participation in this so-called community of practice, of this community performed by the practice, means that you don't only learn from the masters, you learn from everybody else. And this is critical. It's actually a principle that I've been used in my own pedagogical practice for 4 years. Okay, so I always put together people at different stages, different stations of their learning journey. And so the learning can also happen transversally, bottom up and top down. So the masters also learn from the newcomers, especially in recent time where newcomers may know things that the master have not learned when they were newcomers because the technology or the practices have moved on so much. And we know that this creates problems. Again, a lot of studies about this coming out recently. The other thing is that the relationship between master and apprentice change. Okay, so the analytical view of legitimate peripheral participation is that we tend to think of masters and pupil as a static relationship. In fact, as I said, there is a constellations of people at different stages with learning happenings in all what directions, and everybody is moving continuously. The moving creates imbalances and means that the relationship within a so-called community practice is continuously in negotiation. So people argue, okay, about what is the stage. So within a community practice, within people doing the same things, within a real workplace where there are people learning, there is competition for attention with the masters. There's a competition of who does the things. There's competition with access. So the masters has power and is always torn between giving away the knowledge that is putting him above others and perpetuating the practice. So this is important because contrary to the static view of the master passing the information to the pupils, which just like little mama bird giving the worms in the mouth to the birds, we have a much more dynamic social things, which, as I said at the beginning, has power front and center. So the conflict, power negotiations, scheming, envy, negative emotions is always present because there are natural aspects of social life. So learning in practice reflects the reality of practice where all these things happen normally. So as an analytical things make us see more things than just this sort of like dual master pupil things, and which respond also to the questions very often we heard, you know, the comment that community of practice are too harmonious, and but this is the versions that came about 7 years after this book. So the community of practice book that started the cottage industry of community practice was written by Etienne Wenger alone, who basically turned the concept of community practice into a functional thing rather than analytical things. There is a different story to be told, maybe another book, another episode here on the book of Etienne Wenger, which has a very pragmatic story behind it. But the interesting thing is that Leiv didn't want to have anything to do with community practice. So Leiv published only one article after the book, about a couple of years, Learning Community of Practice, is co-authored with Wenger, which was a bit of a summary of the book. And after that, she publicly announced, I was there, she must have said this many times, but I was there one of the times, she announced that she wanted nothing to do with the concept of community practice, because the concept of community had killed or had obfuscated again this lively and conflictual and this sort of power struggle that happens in legitimate peripheral participation processes. Okay, so where the idea that everybody loves each other is harmonious, is just not understanding what's going on.
Another quick plug here is that we had Emma Vast in another PDW at AOM on the classics, in which she talked about the work of Jean Leiv. It's episode 82, in which she talks a little bit of that, right? Exactly on how the concept has been taken up and this aspect has been not taken up and forgotten, so to speak. So that's also an interesting related discussion there.
And it's also why we chose this book to touch in this general field first before going, you know, perhaps reserving communities of practice for later. A lot of the discussion has been really fascinating for me, because when I think about communities of practice, I struggled with a lot of the same sort of a thing. Because on the one hand, you know, I can understand why there would be this desire to have a practical thing that one could draw. And if you're in a consultant role, or if you're trying to help an organization and you want to take the most advantage of what the concepts are in this book, it's hard to argue that building a community of practice is not an obvious or a thing that could be ideal or desirable. But I agree, getting back to the technology and the impact of it, I think about audio and radio mechanics. So I'm a military background. I was in the Signal Corps. And back when I first served, the radios were very mechanical. I mean, it literally, if you were a radio technician, you had the ability to unscrew the top of the thing and, using screwdrivers and pliers, be able to tweak the circuit. Well, they weren't even circuit boards. They were tubes, whatever. That was a long time ago. I don't remember exactly. But you had the ability to manipulate and fix the radio mechanically yourself without a whole lot of equipment. And so then what you had was you had the conditions by which a sergeant would be able to train or to let privates use old radios that were no longer they were just set aside for this purpose, to be able to learn the ropes and become a radio technician. And that you had a team of radio technicians that could go around and fix radios and stuff like that. Now, of course, that whole dynamic changes once you introduced silicon chips and you no longer had the ability to fix the radio yourself. And so then it's not just the matter of like the shifting in relationship of master to apprentice. It's also how team of radio mechanics becomes perceived, because the radio mechanics were once, at one time, went from being the go-to for getting something fixed to now just being the go-between to the entities well outside of the organization that you had to ship it to, because they were the only ones with the technology to fix electronics, you know, radio, something that couldn't be done locally. And so when I think about how, you know, social change and how you're thinking about the learning that goes on, this is an example of how the changes in technology perhaps break a relationship. Is that a fair characterization?
Well, I think this is what Pedro was referring before when he said that learning has to do with acquiring an identity, and that It's not about just learning something, new skills or new concept that you put storing somewhere in your brain.
So the way I thought of that as I was listening to you, Tom, it made me think that maybe one of the broadest points that the book makes is that what is happening in learning, as we said, you know, because it's a dimension of practice, and practice, of course, it's what makes the social world goes, it's ultimately saying that all these dynamics are exactly how the world we live in are reproduced, changed, evolved, enforced, and so on. And there is something on the back of the book that they say in which what the book does and blah, blah, blah. And by viewing agent, activity, and word as mutually constitutive, right? Because I think that's exactly what you're getting at, that all of this, the communities of practice, the process of participation, and so on, is enmeshed in how, you know, inequality goes on, or how technology disrupts people's lives, on how someone's standing in society shifts or goes ups and down, right? It's exactly that. By better understanding such processes, you know, we also better understand what is usually called the macro, the big things, the large phenomena, right? Because they boil down to some extent to how the newcomers learn how to do things and what version of practice gets perpetuated, you know, how clashes between people lead to new synthesis or not, how opportunities are there for people to learn and therefore move up or down in social hierarchies and so on, right? So I think that's an interesting illustration of how all these processes add up to form these larger processes, so to speak.
I would like to just one thing, that the book is very short. In fact, I think it's about 110 pages, 120 pages. And the book was always a way to just to distill the mechanisms and explain the mechanisms. I don't think they use the word mechanisms. I think they use the concept an analytical perspective rather than mechanism. But this is what they were saying. So they're interested in looking at the relationships, different times, different men. But this is what we're saying. It was I know from personal stories that it was a book also written very quickly. So because Leiva and Wenger did not work together for years and years. They had met, and they had, the story goes that they had found these 5 case studies, and they wanted to see what it was in common, and they started to see that there was something underpinning. So proper jointly inductive work. What I'm trying to say is that the book, and one of the power of the book, is that a lot of the things were left open at the time. Okay, some of the things that Pedro was saying were left unfinished. The community practice things was never defined, you know, sort of like the issue of reproductions. The book, very much in a Bourdieu tradition, insists in reproductions rather than change. So there are a lot of discussions about that. Power is put front and back, but is not analyzed. You know, so how the practice changes in the conflict within and between is not analyzed. So a lot of the things, there's a lot of loose ends, but this is actually, I think, one of the strengths of the book. It didn't try to give all the answers. It gave this powerful tools or perspective. It says, guys, this is everywhere. If, you know, because something that applies to places like the Yucatan Midwives, the Alcoholist Anonymous, and the Quartermasters of the American Navy, this is going to be everywhere. In fact, as soon as, you know, Tom, you look around, anywhere from stamp collectors to CB radio transmitters to tennis players to wherever you turn around, you see sort of like things that are amenable to be understood better by these analytical tools. This is so it's also a demonstration, sometimes less is more in terms of analytical purchase. And I think it's worth saying this. And the fact that it's 110 pages should be a good excuse for everybody just to go and read it. You can read it in the afternoon. This is a book that you can read in the afternoon. And if I don't know how many millions of hits it has on Google, but the book is now in the Encyclopedia of Education. You find Theory of Education. This is one. So all started with a book this small. So, you know, so which is encouraging for some of us who struggle to write tomes of, like, you know, Max Weber's 600-700 pages, 2 tomes. It's encouraging.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of their respective organizations or institutions. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. And if so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch via Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you for the conclusion of this episode here on Talking About Organizations.